Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Treasures from Malta podcast. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today is somewhat of a polymath with a multifaceted career. He graduated as a lawyer in 1973 while simultaneously broadcasting programs on radio and TV. Throughout his working life as a lawyer specializing in banking law, he has engaged constantly with the arts. He's a practicing watercolorist as well as an art connoisseur who has penned countless articles and many books about, amongst others, Caravaggio and Turner. He is a published poet and author. He has occupied several posts relating to all of these areas, amongst which are those of Chairman of the Public Broadcasting Services and Chairman of the then newly formed National Book Council. His philanthropic activities include involvement with the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, both as President of the Association and as a Knight. And, most remarkably, the highly important Puccini Cares charity, which started out as a character he created for a children's book, and went on to become a charity which supports patients with serious and terminal illnesses. Philip Farrugia Randon, welcome to the podcast.
Great to join you, Francesca, great to join you. And big hello to all our listeners, of course. Francesca, you're a great interviewer, I hope I will not fool everything.
We're only at the beginning of the interview, so let's not be too hopeful. Philip, you were born in Godzo in 1949, and you'd later marry into a prominent Godston family. But tell us about your childhood.
I was born in Godzo in 1949, AD, of course. Well, at our age, one has to pay attention. My father was a doctor there for 2 years, so Papa had to come back to Malta when I was just 15 days old. But I was baptized there, and I have a G on my ID card, and I'm very proud of that. I try to interpret that as God sent, and not only just Gozo. Came back to Malta. Papa was always a doctor of different villages, so we grew up in villages, when a village was a village, of course. So it was wonderful. It was a free world, until suddenly something terrible happened. When I was 9, my brother John, who was 11 and a half years old, he had a simple appendix. Papa was in the room, in the theater, to assist, not to participate, but to assist the operation. Papa noticed that the anesthetist made a mistake and killed him. And he died there. My father,
oh my goodness,
worse than a Greek tragedy, told this anesthetist, "You have killed my child." Can you imagine? I still feel
indeed
perturbed.
Indeed, how terrible.
And that changed my life.
In what
way? I was blessed in the sense that it changed my life. I mean, we were like twins. We agreed on everything, John and I, except one thing. I wanted to enter university to become a cowboy, and he wanted to enter university to become an Indian. Neither of us managed, but it changed my life in a positive way, luckily enough, in the sense that I became conscious that life is short. Mm-hmm. It's not easy at that age. It's not even easy at my age. But at that age, life is life and full stop. It doesn't have an ending. So suddenly, I still feel it very vividly, I got the sensation that life is short, therefore look around and enjoy. Look around and learn. Look around and absorb. But enjoy, mostly. And that changed my life. Why? Because everything I did from then, I did because I liked doing it. I had chance to choose certain things which made a lot of money. I was not interested in that. Not in not earning money, but I didn't like that, so I did not choose them. And I have remained like that all through my life. So that changed. It changed my perspective, which is a wonderful thing. Another thing which I used to do when I was young, and it's a wonderful memory, is I used to study out in the country. So I used to ride the bike very early in the morning and go to a very small chapel on your way to Gudia, Santa Lucia, it was called, this small chapel. It's a 1,500 chapel, so it's a wonderful place. It was in the middle of nowhere. Nowadays it's all ruined all around. And I used to sit down on the pavis there, a small pavis, and there I used to read, I used to write, I used to study. I studied for all my O levels, A levels, and matric over there. And over there, I used to meet a lot of farmers going in and out. They used to give me food and sleep. And I was sitting on the bridge of Huck, because there were very young farmers who were going out with, or who were dating some girls who were in Australia. And so I used to write their love letters. And it was funny because somebody used to say, no, don't try that. Leave it to me. And I used to write flowery letters, etc. And I used to enjoy it, really enjoy it. One day I got a shock of my life when one of this person, Giorgio Francesco, came with this, I must confess, a very unattractive woman. And this is being very Christian. And she said, and he said, you know who she is? And I said, no. I said, she's going to be my wife. I said, oh, wonderful. I said, thanks to you. I said, oh, my God.
She fell in love with your writing.
She was on the other side in Australia, and she fell in love with, and he got married. I haven't seen him for a long time. I hope he's very happy. But it was one of those things, and I still call that the university of my life, because there I sought myself, there I found myself, I wrote poems, I studied myself a lot, and I still ask the same questions, then and now.
So you were already drawn to the arts, even at an early age. Were you actually exposed to the arts? Were your family particularly interested? Was music being played in the house?
My father, as I said, was a doctor, a medical doctor, but a man of culture. He read in German, in English, in French, in Italian, Maltese, of course. Very in with the arts, so far as painting, sculpture, architecture, and ballet, everything. So, and he also had a good hand. Why? He never drew, but I could see him doodle sometimes when he was at the office. And I once told him, Pa, I said, you have a very good hand. He said, at my age now, forget it. But, and I am still very sorry that I never collected those doodles, which he most probably threw away. But what was good is this. I was blessed with two people in my life. With more, but these two people were very special. My father, my mother I adored, don't get me wrong, I adored. But my father also zoomed in the things which I liked. And he helped me without fuss. Mm-hmm. So when I remember I was young and he went abroad, he was acting as witness in the marriage of Salvino Testaferrata in Germany, and he came back, and I remember he gave me what I think was a very large watercolor box. I don't know whether it was that large, but I started painting, and he used to keep these paintings, which I am sure were not good, but he used to praise them, and he always told me, never throw away your work, because they're always a point of reference. And it's true, and I still don't.
So encouraging.
And he also introduced me, I remember, to... Once he opened his drawer, I was about 9, 10, I don't know. And there were a series of beautiful engravings, but some of them nude, arts. There were Boucher, there were Rembrandt, etc. And he told me, you can look at this now, because he told these words. You can now the difference between the nude, the naked, and the nude. And I could not understand that, to be honest. Years later, when I read the book, The Nude by Kenneth Clark, the first chapter is that, the nude, the naked, and the nude. The second person I was blessed with, which I met later on, and married in 1975, was my wife. Helen, I get very emotional. Helen has been my companion for now almost 50 years. And she has been by my side when I was very ill. But she gave me something. She's a giver. She gave up. She's always giving. She's always helping. She's always, if she hears that somebody else needs something, there she is, going there and helping. But she was there always to see that I have time. Mm. And that is something wonderful. When somebody gives you time, I think it's a beautiful gift. For me it is. Because I need time to read. I need time to study. I need time to paint. I need time. But she gave me time. Not only time, but she gave me the strength and the courage to do things. And when we married, she actually helped me a lot in watercolors, in dedicating myself to watercolors. And she used to give me a lot of courage. No, this is... And she's a very good critic, very good critic. In fact, whenever I do something and I don't really like that corner, I say, let me see Helen. Helen comes in. It's good, but that corner, I said, oh, shoot. But she does it with grace, of course. But Helen has given me time, has given me attention, and has helped me to grow. So I was very, very lucky. Very lucky.
Philip, let's take a step back now. Why were you drawn to study law? Was it your father or somebody in the family?
Why did I take up law? We're a family of doctors and lawyers. My great-grandfather, for whom I'm named Philip, Sir Philip Pocheverras, the Staffarata, was also a doctor. I'm named after him. But there were other lawyers, there were Goffredo, Herbert Granado, Professor Luigi Landon. So, but in those times, Francesca, you were young then, you couldn't really choose a lot, in the sense that the choice was very narrow. The professions were 4 or 5, so, law. Mm-hmm. And I chose law. Am I sorry? No, I'm not sorry, but was it my love? I always say that I always make my love the things I'm working on at the moment, because that makes me happy. That makes me happy, serene, let me put it this way, because happiness is a bit of a, but serene, yes. So I loved law whilst I was practicing as a lawyer, and I wrote a lot about law. Would I choose it again? No.
Philip, having said that, you did leave your mark on the legal profession, and in fact you've written and compiled a number of studies, amongst them aspects of Maltese law for bankers, because you did specialise in banking law throughout your career. You've also written a series of 13 volumes on Maltese court judgments called The Word of the Court. Do you still practice as a lawyer, or have you completely retired from that aspect?
No, I stopped working as a lawyer, and I think a person should not work part-time as a lawyer, because it's dangerous. Yeah. My good old uncle, God rest his soul, used to tell me, un parere dato su due piedi normalmente vale uno dato su quattro. Because if you give an advice off the cuff, it'll be a donkey's advice. And so vale su quattro. Mm-hmm. So no, I stopped that. But I did write a lot of books, yes, and I enjoyed writing them. The aspects of Maltese law for bankers, I wanted to fill in a void, because the bankers were sitting, believe it or not, to get the AIB, they were sitting for law, an exam on law, on English law. Mm-hmm. So they were not studying Maltese law. And I saw this quite stupid. So I wrote a book purposely for that, and it would use as a textbook. Made no money out of it, you know. Then I wrote these 13 volumes, which are still used at court, etc., as a reference, as reference books. But quite dull, of course. I
mean. Doesn't sound like your first love.
But I enjoyed it.
Yes. But also there were other aspects of the arts that you got involved in, even while you were studying law. While you were at university, you were already producing and presenting TV and radio programs. That, which is quite remarkable, because the course in itself is quite time-consuming, and on a parallel you were producing these programs. What sort of programs did you present?
Well, I when I started, I was even before university, because I was about 16 years when I started. I remember I was at the, there was a, some quiz program, and I was with the, seated with the audience, a small audience in the studio, and Lino Spiteri, who was not the politician, but he was the head of programs then, very fine gentleman, at the end came up to me and said, "Would, are you interested in taking up television?" Or I said, "Yeah, why not?" And, well, anyway, I said yes. Then I remember going to this appointment. I was left alone in the studio, nobody there, then some cameraman or sound people came in, and I spoke to them, and they spoke to me, and we exchanged views, etc. And then waiting for this Lino Spiteri to come, but he never arrived for about 15 minutes. Suddenly then he comes up. I hear this voice, "Can you come up, please?" And I said, "Oh, goodness." So I went up, and obviously enough, they were following what I was saying, following my behavior, so how I was asking questions and everything. And then I got some training on, especially on the voice, to keep it half a tone below normal. It was something which I had to do. And then I started with, at the age of 16, before university, I started with a children's program, Daura Duredna. I was very lucky because the director was Alan Meadows, and the producer, believe it or not, was Charles Stake. And on this program, I had some very good people, like Gemma Portelli, Paul Portelli. And I, these were the clowns. And I also had, I remember, I introduced a section of news for children. So I had Pio Spiteri, who was then head of news, and he would adapt the current affairs within these 10 minutes for children.
Philip, I'll interrupt you here. This is in the late 60s, more or less.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Because 69 I started law. Mm-hmm. So it must have been something 66, something like that. But then I moved on to folk music, I remember, with Albert Anastasi. I interviewed a lot of people. Discussion programs, quiz programs. Then I had the love of my life. I presented these, I wrote and produced these six studies on Leonardo da Vinci, which I still love. I still have these studies. I read all his writings, all the commentaries on his writings by Richter, Jean-Paul Richter. And I kept a very healthy correspondence with a certain Professor Carlo Pedretti, who was a world authority. Anyway, I enjoyed, and I won, I don't know, some prize or something like that. But in the meantime, I also did radio, because I had my daily breakfast show in the morning. So at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was on air, which meant at 5:30, a good soul named Lewis used to come with the company van at home and take me to the radio house. That meant only 3 hours sleep, because we used to stop studying at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Group of friends, Gino Camilleri, who used to be with us, God rest his soul, then became a judge, used to drive me back home. And then I used to sleep for 3-4 hours. And
tremendous energy. What energy. Philip, you're also an avid collector of books and a voracious reader, as far as I hear. Now, what do you like reading, and what sort of books do you collect?
I love books. Books are my blood. I've got thousands of them. I love books which offer a sort of, but I don't only have those, of course, which offer a panoramic view of things. So it gives you this general view, and at the same time, if it's well written, it entices you to follow different fields, even at the same time. For example, Ascent of Man by Jacob Bronowski. I remember when I saw the program on BBC, it was in the late early 70s, I was mesmerized. I wrote a letter to Bronowski. Unfortunately, he had just died, because he died very shortly after he finished these programs. I read his book, and I still read this book. I go back to it. Again, this width of knowledge, and at the same time, some sentences which never escape. Daniel Boston is another one who has a series of 3 volumes. Beautiful, the creators, the discoverers, and the seekers. Again, this panoramic view of civilization.
Philip, you're not the first lawyer to practice as an artist. Let's have a look at your art. In fact, there are a number of lawyers who turned to art throughout history. Even in recent time, I can think of people like Vanni Bonello, Albert Gannardo. They've studied art, they've written about art history. In your case, you actually make art. You're a watercolorist. I wonder if it's a reaction to the rigors and discipline of the law that you lawyers turn to art. But tell me a bit about your own art. How long have you been painting? You mentioned that your father had brought a watercolor case home, yes, and you started painting with that. Yeah. How long have you actually been painting, almost professionally?
Almost professionally, I would say after I got married, and Helen, as I said, was my backbone for these kind of things. And I then worked on an exhibition for Pestalozzi Village. Pestalozzi Village was a wonderful thing which attracted intelligent children from third world countries, introduced them to study in London, for example, on the best universities, but then sent them back to their country of origin to help their country. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. Then I took part in other exhibitions in France. I remember going there with the late Esprit Barthet, a character which I will never forget. He, like me, did not drive. So it is not, I wouldn't say it's going away from the disciplines of law. I think it's a love which you have. And I don't think, I think a person can be a good lawyer and a good artist, if you know what I mean. I think he could be a good doctor and a good artist. So I don't think art is an escape from something. It's perhaps an expression, a different type of expression of a character.
Of course, yeah.
Why watercolor? I chose watercolor for a very simple reason, because I'm lazy in the sense that oils, you know, I have to clean and everything. Whilst watercolor is something completely different.
Yeah.
It's much, much neater. Now I'm attempting some acrylics. Well, I haven't painted lately because I'm concentrating on writing. But I would say my painting was not a reaction, but was another me.
Mm-hmm. You're having described your studies and going out into the countryside to study on the pavis of the Church of Santa Lucia. That all makes sense because the subjects of your paintings tend to be very nostalgic. There are village scenes and little corners that are perhaps normally overlooked. And there's a sort of harking back to the Malta that was. Also, looking at your style, I see a looseness in the handling of the paint, which shows familiarity with the medium, and it kind of reminds me of Giuseppe Arcidiacono, who was a great master in the handling of watercolor. And I see also your very light and colorful palette that somehow draws me back to Edward Caruana Dingley. So again, there's a sense of nostalgia. Are you actually influenced by any previous watercolorists? And what are you saying that is new with your art?
First of all, thank you very much for including my name with two giants.
They're not bad, not bad names.
Arcidiacono and Eduardo Caruana Dingley. Edward Caruana Dingley is also related to my wife through her mother, because her mother was a Vert Caruana Dingley. So, but not in my blood, of course. But anyway, influence. I think everybody is influenced. Every artist has been influenced. Even if he doesn't admit it, I think the influence is there. But what I try to get from artists is perhaps a technique, a feeling of color. But the best thing I say, and I always tell my friends, the best thing to learn, to learn when you're painting is to start painting yourself. Why? When you start painting, you make mistakes, of course. But those mistakes sometimes are very interesting. You get these accidental things. Mm-hmm. Which are wonderful. Sometimes you get a color which you've never thought of. Sometimes you say, oh my goodness, this is really good. And you expand on it. You would have never tried it. What do I like painting? You said, looking back, I think now with all the buildings all over Malta, I think looking back has become a wonderful thing to do. But what I like sometimes is the simple things which people can pass and don't even notice them. For example, a dustbin in the corner, or a broken door. But then what really intrigues me is the shadow. They give the shape to things, but they make art. They make this this vivid drama. So I try to include that, even when they are gentle colors. I try to include that intrusion of a shadow, which makes it dramatic sometimes.
Philip, mentioning great names in watercolors, let me throw another name into the mix. Joseph Mallord William Turner,
I've heard about
the famous Turner. You were greatly involved in the purchase of the so-called Malta Turner, which was purchased in 1998 by MidMed Bank. And later, MidMed Bank became HSBC, and they decided to loan it on long-term loan to the National Museum. Now, you were very much involved in the actual negotiation to acquire this painting from Sotheby's.
This is something.
Tell me the story.
Oh, yes. I would say this was a very, very important moment in my life, if not the important moment. I mean, so far as these things are concerned, of course. Because in 1998, as you rightly said, I heard that the only Malta seen by Turner was going to be up for sale by Sotheby's. So I was general manager legal of MidMed Bank, and I spoke to the chairman about this. And it was not a difficult thing, because the chairman then was Dr. Joseph Buttigieg, who was a great lover of the arts, so it took me only a few seconds to convince him. But then, of course, was the exciting part. He gave me carte blanche, and he told me, look, buy it the cheapest you can do, but buy
we'll
it.
Meet the price.
And it was not easy. I knew it was, the private owner was in faraway Japan. And it came up for sale, and I was on the telephone, and I managed to buy it. And I was so excited. At a good price, much, much lower than they thought. Not cheap, but... Then, when I got it, this painting was very well known and not known, because there were a lot of engravings about
one. After it,
yeah. I traced a lot of engravings, but the information about it was wrong. A lot of data, even in museum papers, it was wrong. So the provenance was very poor, so I managed to trace and studied and wrote a book about it. And it took me some time. I managed to trace about 13 different sales. And, you know, that even John Ruskin had it.
That's and wonderful.
John Ruskin, in his diary, mentions in which part of his living room it was. And others, like the mayor of Liverpool, etc. The painting is a small painting, actually. It shows the Grand Harbour. Turner never came to Malta. He never came to Malta. Even though there was somebody who wrote that Turner came to Malta. There was a Turner who did come to Malta, but it was not him.
Wrong Turner.
Why? Because we know that in that period of time, Turner was in Scotland, etc. But anyway, but he painted it, and I had honed in on this time. It was in October, November 1830, and I established at the time because of the studies which I made. And he based this painting, he painted this watercolor as a basis for an engraving. And the engraving was going to be by Edward Findon. Why? There was going to be a book published called Findon's Landscapes Illustrations, where Findon engraved these different countries where Lord Byron visited. Lord Byron was in Malta twice, as you know, and so Malta had to be included. And this is why it came in the story. So most probably, even though we have not, but I think Turner based himself on a British painter, Reinagle. Reinagle was in Malta in 1827, we know, and most probably he was in Ricasoli, where there was a temporary hospital which was accepting the sick and the wounded from the Battle of Navarino. Then what's interesting is this. So MidMed Bank bought the painting. When there was a transfer from MidMed Bank to HSBC, this painting was not kept, not retained by the government. So it was transferred also to HSBC. And I used to see it every day, of course. It was in the CEO's room and I used to check it whether it's good or not. I was in love with this painting, of course. And I always wanted this painting to end in Maltese hands. So one fine day in 2002, there was this very interesting person, Chris Hothersall, who was the CEO. And I was speaking to him and I was hinting and hinting and hinting. And I always like, if I want a big decision, I always like the person who is going to decide to make it his. Mm-hmm. So I let him, 1, 2, 3, 4, ergo, mm-hmm. and he came up with the conclusion, Philip, so I think the government should. I said, oh, well, that's wonderful news. So, lo and behold, I contacted the authorities, who of course said yes, and it was then loaned it to the fine arts, and it is still there. So I think that was something which I still feel thrilled when I look back.
A real feather in your cap and a great contribution to Malta. You mentioned that you used to walk into the CEO's office to look at the painting and to check if it's all right. And this reminds me that you actually did a course in restoration of paintings in Florence.
Yes,
in 1988. What was the objective of that? I mean, that is more of a scientific approach to art, and I'm sure you weren't going to pursue a new career.
Well, I believe that all knowledge is one. There's a wonderful sentence by T.S. Eliot. And the fire and the rose are one. The fire and the rose are one. Why? We look at things from one aspect, but in reality, everything is one. All knowledge. You look at a painting, for example, and you look at it and you say, ah, wonderful. And you look at it from the artistic point of view, the composition, the balance, etc. Then the colors, yes, wonderful. And then you see, oh, wait a minute, there's some symbols in it. That means something, that means that, so you're going away further from art. Then, oh, wait a minute, that's the history of the painting and the history of the story which is being told. Then the hard facts, the chemistry of it. Who made, what material was made? Why is it decaying? Why is the color changing green when the color underneath was blue? So that is the conservation of the art. So everything mixes to get one. So I think studying the conservation and restoration was nothing extraordinary in the sense it helped me look at art from another angle, but it's the same coin after all. I spent a few months over there in Florence, and Helen and my daughter came with me, of course. Then, of course, I practiced a bit of restoration, but to be honest, I did not go there to become a restorer. But I read a lot, and I can still read a lot and understand a lot, because I had this backing. So this is why, Even as I said, my books, when I said, you know, science is art, etc., you're not really reading different subjects. You are looking at the same thing, but from a different angle. And the fire and rose are one.
It seems to me that curiosity really fuels your life. But, Philip, let's take a break, and then we'll come back to find out more about your life. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, author Philip Farrugia Randon. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Philip, coming away from the hands-on approach to art that we've been discussing so far, you're also an art connoisseur and an art writer. In fact, you've written extensively, and on the invitation of prestigious foreign universities and institutions, you've lectured overseas about the great Baroque painter Caravaggio. What do you feel is new about your approach that hadn't already been covered in Caravaggio's studies?
you emphasize something which is interesting on my approach. What is new on my approach? These are not lectures. They are narrations, which I delivered in Bonham's in London, or Washington, I remember in Smithsonian, full up, wonderful, I had a standing ovation, The Hague, in Berlin, in Denmark, in Taormina, in Canada. Why is that a narration? Because if I'm speaking about Caravaggio or the knights, the story of the knights of Malta, I speak in the first person singular. So, on Caravaggio, I am Caravaggio. I am speaking. I am leading the people to my story. If it's about the knights of Malta, I am the knight who has lived for 1,000 years. Now, that is not enough, of course. At the back, I have it's about an hour and a quarter narration. So I have about 300 to 350 paintings moving on the screen. And changing according to a script, of course, mm-hmm. following a script. But at the same time, also background music, which enters and fades. So it is a living documentary. Mm-hmm. But then, and this is where my background of television and stage, because I did a lot of stage too, comes in. There's acting in it too. Mm-hmm. So I would read a wonderful passage by one of the grand masters before he dies. So the listener, is there, and he's seeing a live commentary with new music, with pictures, with sounds and acting. So it's a completely different angle. And it does leave a good taste. I enjoy doing it in any case.
It certainly animates the story of Caravaggio or the Knights of the Order of St. John, and it's a very personal take as well, because you've obviously studied and researched and read a lot about the subject, so you know exactly what you're talking about. But again, there's an element of entertainment, which we are increasingly looking at, even in the way we interpret museums nowadays. People need to enjoy themselves, otherwise there's no way they're going to stop and listen. Mm-hmm. It's crucial. It really is crucial, especially in this day and age when attention spans have reduced so dramatically. You have to grab people with interesting facts, beautiful images, and just basically get them to enjoy themselves. And that is the best way to take in knowledge.
Very much so. Try not to make professors of people mm-hmm. who are following you.
Yep.
Try and make them interested viewers.
Mm-hmm. The tendency is to want to cram information
yes.
and to give them as much as you know.
Yes.
But unfortunately, it's perhaps the wrong thing to do.
Wrong thing.
Because you cannot cram a lifetime's research and reading into an hour's lecture. But you're also writing a book about St. John's Cathedral,
yeah.
which takes a wider, more contextualized approach to the treasures that there are at St. John's. Of course, you know the Cathedral well. You've had a long association with the Managing Foundation. You've acted as its president on a number of occasions. Can you elaborate further about this book you are writing? And
yes.
when can we expect to see it in the bookshelves?
$1,000 question. Yes, I almost finished it. It's almost finished. The
mm-hmm.
text is almost finished. I'm rereading and arranging a few things, etc. But I've written this book on St. John's, and I want to publish it. It's not just touring around, again, more or less of a narration. It's not touring just the beautiful things that are, etc., and speaking about them. But I'm putting St. John's and its contents as part, as a trampoline to Malta's history. So I am going in and out of St. John's all the time. For example, there are statues of slaves, for example, part of the monument. I talk about slavery in Malta, which was a very vast thing. Then go back to St. John's, and if I'm talking about the Chapel of Italy, I'm talking about Italy and Malta, how we depended on Italy, on Sicily, for example, for hundreds of years for our food. Again, there could be a corner there which takes you to another world. For example, there's a plaque on your way to the sacristy, a dark plaque. It's about the 1913 Eucharistic Congress, very uninteresting as such. But then I talk about the Eucharistic Congress, mm-hmm. but not just that. I go in and I zoom into a meeting which was taking place between Dunkarn, our national poet, and Maestro Caruana. And they were discussing in St. John's itself to write something for the Eucharistic Congress, which had to be sung during Holy Communion. So Dunkarn agreed, or even hummed the tune, and Caruana said, "Oh, excellent, 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 okay." And Dunkarn said, "Okay, I'll write the words." What happened was, this was sung in Italian, because the Eucharistic Congress meant that a lot of, you know, foreigners were coming, etc. So they couldn't do it in Maltese. And this song, the music was called Taduram Ostia Divina, Nadurauk Yahobsta Sema, which we now sing. Nobody knew who wrote it. Why? Because this was just written there. But there was an Italian prelate who actually took it with him, and this went abroad, etc., with anonymous, anonymous, anonymous. Dunkarn didn't like it, so he wrote about it, etc. But the funny thing is that this present Pope, Pope Francis, mm-hmm. once there was a concert choir visited him and sang Taduram Ostia Divina in Italian. And he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "From where did you get this music?" And he said, "This is Maltese." He said, "No, this is the music which accompanied me for my first Holy Communion." And they told him, they gave him the background, and they sang it to him in Maltese this time. So there it is, a small corner. Mm-hmm. So this is,
opens up a huge story, actually.
So I'm quarrelling between the bishops and the inquisitors, and I'm about problem shouting within St. John's, and who's buried there, what are they? Are they all there, is it true? No, some of them are not there. Uh-huh. So there's a lot of coming in and out.
It sounds almost like the script of a documentary. It can very easily turn into a documentary, because it has a filmic sort of approach to it.
Yes, yes. Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely.
Philip, you've also written countless articles about art and artists. Which would you say were the more important and groundbreaking studies?
I think the most groundbreaking was the Turner one, I would say. I go back to it, because the Turner one was, I discovered a lot of new things, and it had a wonderful result, you know, something that was lost.
It's tangible as well, because it's one tangible. Reads this, and then you can go and see the painting at the Museum of Fine Arts or at MUSA.
Right.
Yeah. But Philip, you're also an author of children's literature, and in fact you started out in your media career, if you like, with tackling children as an audience, and in 2001 you created the character of Putino, who was a little angel who went on to become the mascot of a charity, which has grown and grown, and it's become a lifesaver for patients who are facing impossible situations due to their serious illness. Now, what prompted the creation of Putino? And are you involved in the voluntary organization that was set up?
I'm not involved at the moment. And here I salute the memory of Dr. Calvanian, a giant. And also I salute René Zerafa, who has been the soul of Putino. Well done. Now, what was Putino? How did it come around? HSBC, I convinced HSBC that we should have a foundation to help children. So it was a children's foundation. And when it was 1 year old, they asked me to write something for children. And I said, okay. And I said, I thought about sick children or the blind children. So I started writing short stories, which I would record on a CD. And I wrote the first, second, third, and sixth story. Then the seventh story was about this small angel, the smallest angel in heaven, who couldn't even fly. So he was taught how to fly by St. Joseph and then by the archangel. And he fell down one day and he ended up in Malta. And he was taken care by Tonino. Nobody could see him except this boy. And these are the adventures, I would say, but always with very fine lessons. And not dogmatic. I mean, I'm not trying to preach. Mm-hmm. And funny things like the story like me writing those. There's a lot of autobiography in the story. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I recorded them. And I said, no, forget the others. This is going to be Puttino. I recorded them, and then the band told me, you know what, there should be a book also. And I said, okay, no problem. And he said, but who's going to do the illustrations? And I swear, they looked at me. And I said, of course, I'd do it. Well, this was free, don't get me wrong. So I did the illustrations. So I actually created Puttino. I painted Puttino. What you see in the Puttino Cares logo, mm-hmm. it's my painting.
His image and his character.
And they cannot totally change it. But yeah. what happened with them? Very shortly after, very, very shortly after, Puttino Cares was just formed. Well, Puttino Cares, it wasn't Puttino Cares, it was just a small volunteer organization. And Claudia De Maria, she phoned me up and she said, Philip, we have this small organization and we need a mascot. Are you prepared to allow us to use it? And I said, of course, no problem at all. No money at all, but you cannot change it, of course. They said, it's my baby, it's the name, etc. That's how it started. And Puttino Cares, then we started helping it as a small organization. And it grew, it grew, it grew. It's my baby. Puttino is mm-hmm. my baby. And I have lots of love for him. And in fact, what I want to do now is, as soon as I finish this book, I will have to publish my poems, because Helen is always saying, publish your poems. But I have to also also publish the Puttino stories again, because they're out mm-hmm. of, they were sold out, and add on to them. Perhaps also, besides Maltese, I would do it in English, mm-hmm. but also do a recording and books. So, and of course, all the proceeds will go to Puttino Cares, of course.
It all helps the charity. The charity started out as a charity for children who were suffering from cancer, but it just went on, and now helps adults and other people who have terminal illnesses.
God bless them. God bless
so it is,
God bless
it is wonderful and really worth mentioning at this stage. But let's go back to another aspect that you've hinted upon. You mentioned poetry and that you should be publishing your poems. You've already published a number of your poems, but I'm going to ask you to read out one of them. And let's talk about it afterwards.
Okay, I've chosen this. A Treasure That Was Never Yours, which I had written for my dear friend Alex Mancher, who, again, is not only a heart specialist, but is also a very accomplished painter, a very accomplished pianist. Search, my friend, and when you see, engage your spirit, which will set you free. Ask, my friend, and when you find, then cage it firmly in your thirsty mind. But you will never own what you have sipped and dined. What you have found will only energize your mind. So share your spirit with a writing pen. Lay bare your knowledge, for it is only then that you bequeath a treasure that was never yours.
Philip, I selected this poem because it talks about treasures. And of course, this podcast is called Treasures from Malta. Patrimonio is all about treasures, but all about sharing treasures. And the whole point of Patrimonio is to discover treasures in private collections and in the state collection, and to share them with the public. In a way, we're also accepting that treasures don't actually belong to people, but they belong to the national, to the international community, if you like. And the only way to share them is to share them by publishing them, by studying them, by appreciating them and caring for them.
That's all.
It's tied up so beautifully with who we are and what we do. Philip, when you write poetry, how is it? What is your process like? Do you write often? Do you write to let off steam, or just as a means to divert your mind from other concerns? When do you write? What time of day?
Well, I'm a very erratic person. I can do a lot of things and then not do anything. Write a lot of things and not write anything then, or paint a lot of things and not paint anything. And poetry falls within this scheme of things, I would say. There are times when I, somehow or another, I vent off. There are times where a sentence would help me, or a sentiment would help me. There are times when I'm madly in love with my wife and I want to write. I wrote a lot of poems dedicated to Helen because it's easy for me to write about her. Because as I said, Helen gives, and she has been my spirit. So it's easy to write about Helen, but sometimes it's also about something which has been forgotten, and I want to remind people of something simple. But there's no real systematic way, I must say. I write it. Do I correct it? Yes or no. I think you can always go back to something and rewrite it. So, but that's not good to do it. Mm-hmm. Write another poem then, but don't try to change. But there are people, to be honest, who go back and change it and change it again and change it. It becomes something completely different.
That's not your style.
It's not my style.
No, it's spontaneous expression. Okay. Philip, other aspects of your life. In 2005, you were made member of the National Order of Merit. What does this honour mean to you?
It means a lot. I would be not sincere if I say that. No, it means a lot. Not the honour, but the question of being acknowledged. Mm-hmm. An acknowledgement is something which doesn't have a price, but yes, is a treasure. I will not believe anybody who says, I couldn't care less whether I'm acknowledged or not. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about honours, nothing but acknowledged. Of course, when it's such an honour, then it means that at least you have reached mm-hmm. somebody else. And as I said in the beginning, I was always conscious that my life is short, that I had to do something. So this acknowledgement...
It's a pat on the shoulder.
...has its own place.
Yeah. Philip, you're also a Knight of Malta in the rank of... Now, let me see if I'm going to get this correct. In the rank of Grand Cross, Magistral Grace in Obedience. Now, that's quite a mouthful, and to me it seems ritualistic with all these titles and anachronistic robes and regalia. I mean, really and truly, how relevant and useful is this role? And even the Order of Malta itself in contemporary society.
Okay. That's a good question, because a lot of people misunderstand that. And a lot of people emphasize this titles and robes. In actual fact, we don't really have robes. What we have is a very dark cloak, which we wear only in church. Very simple cloak with a Maltese cross, but nothing grand, etc. But what is the Order of Malta? Is it titles? No. There are 13,500 members all over the world, and 95,000 volunteers, with a qualified staff of about 52,000. Now, what do they do? We start from the micro-micro to the macro-macro. The micro-micro is help the poor and the sick every day. The macro would be from emergency relief for refugees, for example. Natural disasters. Hospital work. We are active in 120 different countries, which is wonderful. And there are a lot of social care programs. So there are also places where they are specializing in dementia patients. In Italy, for example, in Rome, you have very high officials, very highly titled people, who within the evening go underneath the bridges and incognito and help and give food to the poor people who do not even have a home where to stay. We support and directly manage hundreds of medical centers, 20 hospitals, over 110 homes. So we're talking about an enormous organization which does a lot of good. Mm-hmm. What I find missing, however, and I must admit, is that we do not advertise so much about it. Sometimes I feel that if we brag too much, people will say, oh, you do good and shut up. Mm-hmm. And perhaps they're right, do good and don't talk about it. But when then people misunderstand what you are and who you are and what you stand for, In Malta, for example, they have people who are visiting foreign prisoners and talking to them and helping them. Mm-hmm. Sick people, we take people to Lourdes. Mm-hmm. We pay everything for them. Some people have nobody else to take care of. Some people haven't seen the members of the family for years. We don't get this in newspapers. Mm-hmm. It's a balance which it's difficult to find. Mm-hmm. Should we speak about it more, but seem as if we're showing off? But at the same time, you need to speak about it because people should follow your example. We have a lot of youngsters who actually help. So, we do not have all these regalia. Some of the titles are just given and nothing. We never get it. When we write our names, we don't say Chevalier. Mm-hmm. When somebody writes Chevalier, 99.9999% he's not a member of the Order of Malta.
Some other order.
He's another order which is not even recognized.
So the whole point is legacy in a way. So you keep these titles alive because of the history of the order, which is a millennial history. Otherwise, really, it's all about charity and philanthropy.
Only that.
Yeah.
Only that. Mm-hmm.
Now, Philip, your poems may be soulful and your published work very serious, but there's an entertainer in you. Now, I'm told that you're known to burst into song in an event, and you can sing Anna as well, which is our traditional Maltese folk music, and you make up verses spiritu pront. Apparently, they're really funny. Now, are these reports about you correct?
Yes, they are very correct.
Fully admit to them.
Fully admit. I've written hundreds of them about people, about friends, taking the mickey out of them and really enjoying it. But if you are going to ask me to do something here, I am sorry to disillusion you, but no, for two reasons. This is not the right place, I think, and to be honest, I decided also to stop making a fool of myself.
Oh, come on, can't you do that tomorrow?
But I can see a tear in your eyes. And I hate young ladies crying. So close your eyes. Michael Lowell phoned to ask me, do you want an intervista? Alaska. كم سري خلصني علي فري عشاك بس نستع كونترا قلبي جيت في الستوديو ويت فرانشيسكا تا بالسان لو البروميست مي I'd like it now you see it's so much fun. Il Francesca asked me questions. Al kul wahda, she asked tnain. Basta yaidu, kemmi brava. I called in Ida, the evil for Francesca. Istaqsibis, ma wijbet shane. Well, in prose, I thank Francesca for her patience and her time. And for suffering me to answer both in prose as well as rhyme. So that's me.
That's you, Philip, indeed. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your life with us. Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.